Nikki Strong. I'm looking forward to checking them out. VOA 1.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant, Katie Weaver, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
Businesses in the central parts of cities are losing huge profits as a result of the pandemic. With offices nearby, the businesses used to be filled with workers seeking breakfast, lunch, and everyday goods and gifts. With offices still closed and workers remaining at home, some businesses are adapting to the changed market. Surviving businesses have taken steps like doing more online sales, changing hours, cutting back workers, or selling new things. Business owners had looked forward to the return of nearby workers this month as offices reopened. But as COVID-19 cases rise again, many offices have delayed plans to bring workers back. Now, downtown businesses in the U.S. and overseas wonder if the changes may become permanent. In the American city of Detroit, Michigan, Mike Frank's dry cleaning business was running out of money. Frank started Clifford Street Cleaners 8 years ago. Before the pandemic, monthly revenue was about $11,000. But by December 2020, it had dropped to $1,800, he said. Frank had to borrow money from his wife to pay the bills. I was almost ready to go out of business, he said. Instead of closing, Frank adapted. He changed part of his store into a small market. Now he sells all kinds of cleaning products, bottled water, soft drinks, and other goods. He also added a delivery service. Finally, some foot traffic returned. With the combination of product sales and dry cleaning, revenue is back up to about $4,100 each month, he said. That is enough to keep the business open. And he noted the revenue is increasing each month. In New York City's Lower Manhattan area, 224 businesses closed their doors in 2020 and 2021. That information is from the Alliance for Downtown New York. It says about 100 businesses have opened. Jessica Lappin is president of the organization. There's no question it's hard for business areas, she explained to the Associated Press. We miss our workers. Lappin predicts office workers will come back, but it might be 2 or 3 days a week on different days or at different hours. A block from New York's financial neighborhood, workers would wait in long lines to buy one of the healthy meals from Blue Park Kitchen. Things are completely different, owner Kelly Fitzpatrick said. Online orders now make up 65% of the business. Those sales are less profitable, however, because Fitzpatrick has to give a percentage to the app company she uses for online orders. In all, the Blue Park has let 9 of its workers go.
Nearby, Aniket Malhotra and his brother took over Banaras, an Indian restaurant, in 2019. Most of their customers were bankers. When the pandemic hit, those customers disappeared. No one came in for the $13 lunch special the restaurant was known for. In the past, lunch sales represented 95% of the restaurant's business. Now, Benares has about 10 lunch orders a day, down from 100. But also now, business is back to around 70% of levels before the pandemic. The brothers established a delivery service and began offering nighttime meals. The customers are now mostly younger people and families who live in the area. It's nice to see not just corporate people downtown, said Malhotra. Jorge Guzman is an assistant professor of business at New York's Columbia University. He said the move of economic activity away from downtowns will likely continue, but there are new businesses opening in non-downtown areas. Downtowns are not going to die exactly, Guzman said, but it's going to be a little bit more of a mix, more residential and mixed-use businesses. In the British capital of London, office workers have been slowly returning. The government lifted COVID-19 restrictions on July 19th as the number of new infections began to drop. Recently, however, cases have been climbing again. The number of downtown workers is far lower than before COVID. It was good. It was busy before the pandemic, said Rado Asatrian. He has worked as a haircutter at a beauty shop in the financial area for 6 years. Before COVID-19, he usually had 10 to 15 customers a day. Now he sees 3 or 4 a day. Asatrian said he may move to a busier area, change professions, or move overseas. In some downtowns, tourists are visiting again, helping businesses stay open. In the U.S. city of Atlanta, Georgia, Kwan's Deli and Korean Food has almost as much summer business as it did before the pandemic. During the worst part of the pandemic, Kwan's had lost about 80% of its business. But the situation is improving, thanks to travelers and events happening nearby. Still, the coronavirus is causing a lot of unknowns about the autumn. Kwan's owner, Andrew Song, said he heard that some businesses have moved permanently or downsized. It's sort of hard to imagine what it will look like, he said, with office workers not returning. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
Researchers have created the first complete map of the world's coral reefs. Development of the map was led by scientists at Arizona State University. They partnered with coral reef scientists, universities, nonprofit organizations, and private groups across the world. The online map is designed to be a coral conservation tool that can also support ocean planning and coral science activities. Called the Allen Coral Atlas, the map was named after Microsoft's late co-founder, Paul Allen. Allen's private company, Vulcan Inc., started providing financial support to the project in 2017. The idea came out of an effort by researcher Ruth Gates of Hawaii to create super coral to help save reefs. When announcing the launch of the map recently, the creators said it is the first worldwide detailed map of its kind. It gives users the ability to see detailed information about local reefs, including different kinds of undersea structures like sand, rocks, seagrass, and coral. The maps include areas up to 15 meters deep. They are meant to inform policymakers facing decisions about protected ocean areas, plans for structures and seawalls, and coral renewal projects. Greg Asner led the effort to create the Atlas. He is the director of Arizona State University's Center for Global Discovery and Conservation. He told the Associated Press that for the first time, the project had created a uniform mapping of the entire coral reef system. Asner said the researchers depended on a network of hundreds of field volunteers who provided local information about reefs. This enabled the team to program the satellites and software to study the right areas. The map includes a coral bleaching tool to identify corals that are struggling because of climate change and other problems. Asner said about 75% of the world's reefs had not been mapped in such a complete way before. He noted that many had not been mapped at all. The University of Queensland in Australia used artificial intelligence technology and local data to help build the Atlas. Anyone can look at the maps for free online. Both Allen and researcher Ruth Gates died in 2018, leaving Asner and others to carry on their work. Asner said Gates would be so pleased that this is really happening. Asner said many of the calls he is receiving are from researchers who hope to use the maps to be sure that their planning and their reef restoration work is going to have its max efficacy. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Andrew Jackson was nearing the end of his presidency. He had served two terms. For many Americans, Jackson remained incredibly popular. They liked that a poor boy from the frontier who could barely read and write, grew up to become president. Historian Daniel Feller is an expert on Andrew Jackson. He calls the president and war hero the ultimate American self-made man.
He's a quintessentially American figure. You can't imagine anybody like this getting to be the head of a country at that time, certainly anywhere else but in the United States. And even in the United States, it would have been unheard of just a few years before.
Daniel Feller says Jackson often used government to help ordinary people instead of the rich and powerful. For this reason, many called him the people's president. But not everyone agreed. His opponents said, "Tyrants have always spoken in the name of the people." They said Jackson used his popularity to do whatever he wanted, whether it was legal or not. His opponents in Congress even denounced him with a censure resolution for not releasing some of his papers to the government. They called him King Andrew. Many American Indians called Jackson yet another name. They called him Jackson the Devil. Jackson wanted Native Americans in southern states, including Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee, to move west. Jackson did not think it was right for Indian tribes to exist as independent nations within the United States. And white voters wanted Indians' land for farming. Historian Daniel Feller points out that the United States government had tried to get Indians to move away from white settlements for a long time, long before Jackson became president.
But Jackson brought an urgency to it that none of his predecessors had. Quincy Adams and Monroe had endeavored to remove Indians when Indians seemed to be willing to be removed. Jackson took the position that they need to be removed now.
In 1830, Jackson pushed a bill through Congress called the Indian Removal Act. The bill allowed him to create new Indian homelands in the Oklahoma Territory, an area west of the Mississippi River, where few white Americans lived at the time. The federal government would essentially trade the Indians their old land for the new land and pay for tribes to move west permanently.
He managed to convince himself, and I think that's the best way to put it, that he was actually doing the Indians a favor, that Indian tribes that remained in proximity to whites simply disintegrated. Their tribal structure, their national structure disintegrated. They died.
Daniel Feller says just because Jackson believed he was helping the Indians did not mean he did not benefit from their removal or that he was right. Besides, the Indians did not have much choice. Jackson told them that if they did not accept his offer, their nations would be controlled by the American government. The Chickasaw, Choctaw, and Creeks agreed under pressure. The Cherokees resisted. They even took their case to the Supreme Court, which agreed that the Indians were independent from state authority. But Jackson and the state of Georgia ignored the Supreme Court's decision. Eventually, soldiers forced the Cherokees from their homes and marched them over 1,600 kilometers to Oklahoma. More than 5,000 died. The forced march later became known as the Trail of Tears. Even the Indians who survived continued to suffer. The United States government did not meet the terms of the treaty. Few Indians were paid for their goods. Most were not given food and other supplies during the journey or when they arrived in Oklahoma. Daniel Feller notes that the United States has a long history of defaulting on its treaties with Indian nations, both before and after Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson might not have intended for the Indians to suffer so much, but he did not lead his government to respect and protect them either.
There are many who regard Jackson as being the kind of epitome, the exemplar, the personification of everything that has been wrong, not only regrettable, but perhaps evil, in white America's treatment of the Indians.
Daniel Feller says Jackson's treatment of the Native Americans, along with some of his other actions, complicates his image as an American hero.
If you look at Jackson's own personal rise, it's a pretty impressive rise. It leaves a lot of dead people and a lot of displaced or abused populations behind it, including Indians, including slaves, including personally the people he shot. So, again, it's a complicated image. It shows this American character in both, you might say, its best and its most disturbing light at the same time.
In 1836, the American public voted for their next president. Andrew Jackson had served for 8 years. He did not want another term. He supported his vice president, Martin Van Buren. Van Buren had been very close to the outgoing president. In the election of 1828, Van Buren had been successful in forming a strong political alliance. This alliance helped put Jackson in the White House. Jackson was grateful for Van Buren's help and asked him to come to Washington to serve as Secretary of State. Van Buren quickly became the most powerful man in Jackson's cabinet. He was able to help Jackson in negotiations with Britain and France. But his greatest help was in building a strong political party for Jackson. Van Buren built up the Democratic Party by removing people from government jobs if they had not supported Jackson. These jobs were then given to those who had supported the president. Ultimately, it was the Democratic Party that gave Jackson wide support for his policies. Van Buren served as Jackson's Secretary of State for 2 years. By this time, Jackson had decided that Van Buren would be the best man to follow him as president. Jackson offered to resign after the 1832 elections and give Van Buren the job of president. Van Buren rejected the offer. He said he wanted to be elected by the people, but he agreed to be Jackson's vice president in 1832. 4 years later, at Jackson's request, the Democrats chose Van Buren to be their presidential candidate. Several candidates from the newly formed Whig Party opposed him, but the Whigs were divided, and Van Buren easily won the election. March 4th, 1837 was a bright, cold day. The winter sun shone over the crowd that had gathered in Washington to watch the swearing-in of the new president. Andrew Jackson left the White House in the presidential carriage, riding beside Martin Van Buren. It was the first time a president and a president-elect rode to the Capitol together for the inauguration. The big crowd on the east side of the Capitol grew quiet when Jackson and Van Buren walked up the steps of the building. After Chief Justice Roger Taney swore in President Van Buren, the new president gave his inaugural speech. Then Andrew Jackson started slowly down the steps. A mighty cheer burst from the crowd. "For once," wrote Senator Thomas Hart Benton, an ally of Jackson, "the rising sun was eclipsed by the setting sun." The day after Van Buren became president, Jackson met with a few of his friends. Frank Blair, the editor of Jackson's newspaper, was one of them. Senator Benton was another. It was a warm, friendly meeting. They thought back over Jackson's years in the White House and talked about what had been done. Jackson said he thought his best piece of work was getting rid of the Bank of the United States. He said he had saved the people from a monopoly of a few rich men. Someone asked about Texas. Jackson said he was not worried about Texas. That problem would solve itself, he said. Did he have any regrets about anything? "Only two," said Jackson. "I regret I was unable to shoot Henry Clay or to hang John C. Calhoun." The next morning, March 6th, Jackson left Washington to return to his home in Tennessee. Jackson was to leave the Capitol by train. Thousands of people lined the streets to the train station, waiting for a last look at their president. Jackson stood in the open air on the rear platform of the train. His hat was off, and the wind blew through his long white hair. The locomotive bell rang, there was a hiss of steam, and the train began to move. Jackson bowed. One man who was there said it was as if a bright star had gone out of the sky. Jackson lived for 8 more years. He read as many as 20 different newspapers, exchanged letters with many people in government, and spent time with his son and grandchildren. But Jackson's health had never been very good. He had been shot many years before, and the gunshot wounds created problems. Andrew Jackson died at home on June 8, 1845. He was 78 years old. Back in Washington, Martin Van Buren continued Jackson's legacy by carrying out many of his policies. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.